I will work day in and day out.
Wake up and smell the coffee.
We want to return to the European Union.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order! Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined once again by Nick Thomas-Simmons, Shadow Minister Without Portfolio, Member of Parliament to Torvan, and author of Attlee, A Life in Politics, a recent updated edition of which has just been published, which will be the subject of today's podcast. Welcome back to the podcast, Nick.
Absolutely delighted to be joining you, Will.
It's a delight to have you on once again. Now, the first question I'd like to ask is one of two parts. Why did you want to write this book in the first place? And why did you want to release a new edition of it?
Well, firstly, because I think when you look at the prime ministerial league tables, and by the way, as a historian, I find the concept very difficult, but nonetheless, let's accept that certain historians do produce these things. Clem Attlee almost always comes up as in the top one or two of the post-war prime ministers, and quite rightly so. And when I originally wrote the book, it was for publication in 2010. It was because not only did I want to see why it was that he was so successful, but also this paradox, in a sense, as to why a government that achieved so much nonetheless was out of office after around about 6.5 years and condemning the Labour Party to to 13 years in opposition after that. So I was fascinated by him. Now, in terms of reissuing it this autumn, it just seemed to me we are in a period where when you go on the doorsteps, people are talking about time for a change. Of course, really, you'd expect me to say that we're not taking anything for granted and we're going to fight for every vote over the next 12 months. But it just seems to me that as we have a period where possibly we could have once again privilege of going into government, it seemed a sensible moment to reflect on a Labour leader who succeeded so well with the levers of power after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And of course, the book begins with a discussion of Attlee's childhood. And what I think is interesting in the book is that you make clear that his upbringing is one of very solidly middle class and Victorian. How much of an impact do you think that moderately Anglican established middle class background had on Attlee? And how similar or indeed different do you think his upbringing was as compared to the upbringing of other members of his cabinet?
Well, his background is obviously a complete contrast to the first Labour Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, who obviously grew up in abject poverty in Scotland. And it's also very different to, say, somebody like Ernest Bevin or Aneurin Bevan or indeed Herbert Morrison. Very, very different. I think what's fascinating, though, is he's shaped by his childhood, but he's not defined by it. And he, of course, goes to Northall Place Prep School, goes to Haileybury, then on to Oxford University, and briefly practiced as a barrister, but didn't really have very many cases. And you can't help but think that it was his father, who, of course, was a solicitor, who was president of the Law Society, who had an influence on Attlee's initial choice of career. Though when it's interesting that when his father passes away in the later part of 1908, it's not long after that Attlee leaves being a barrister. But the other things I think that come from Attlee's childhood are his patriotism. He often spoke of Queen Victoria's, it was the 1897 Jubilee. It would he had these memories of the Jubilees. I think he had that in his head. He always had this reverence for our constitution, this reverence for the monarchy. But also, I think he had this profound sense of service that came from that background as well. He then, of course, leaves Oxford, as I've said. But what I think is the transformative moment from this very conventional, middle class, as you say, high Anglican, pro-monarchy, attended obviously independent schools background, was, and he said it himself, it was when he went to the Stepney Boys Club, which was a club run by Hayley Bree in the East End of London, essentially to help out poorer people. And it's that that transforms Attlee, because he starts to see up close the impact of poverty. And the conclusion that he drew then, which I think has a profound influence for his whole political career, is that you couldn't rely on irregular private charity to produce a more equal society in a way perhaps that Victorians saw charity as very important. Of course, he wasn't denigrating the notion of charity. He wasn't denigrating the notion of people wanting to give money to good causes, but he drew the conclusion that to deal with inequality, what you had to have was a government that was willing to make those changes. And it's that he identifies himself in his autobiography as transformational. And I think it colours his whole career as a politician.
Absolutely. And one of the things that Attlee starts to do at around this time, one thing I found particularly fascinating when reading the book, was he begins to write poetry along a political line. How important do you think that poetry was in terms of him articulating his own opinions and beliefs? And why do you think he chose that particular medium of expression? Because it's an interesting one for someone who is, you know, often associated with great reforming changes to the British state, seen as someone of very serious character, to have this early association with poetry and this early creation.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because he had this extraordinary love of literature and of poetry. He wrote an article in later life where he was talking about how much he treasured his book collection, and he saw different books like old friends that he'd picked up at different parts of his life. And he also remembered he was very young indeed, I think younger than 10, when Alfred Lord Tennyson died. And he could remember that even when he was older, and the significance of, you know, the great Tennyson, you know, and his almost capturing of the Victorian mind. What I think is also significant, though, he always liked to pen poetry. But you have to remember, too, that he doesn't meet his future wife, Violet Attlee, as she became, until after World War One. So there wasn't that person in his life that he could go home and confide to and speak to about awful things that happened during the day. So what he tended to do was to find expression in poetry. But in one sense, poetry is very Attlee, because Attlee never liked to waste words. Attlee was succinct. And in one sense, the medium of poetry, where you do try to express yourself in that very, very restricted way, in a sense, perhaps captures something about him as well, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you mentioned the First World War there, and of course, Attlee served during the First World War, eventually becoming a major at its end. But could you just explain what impact that had on him, and also the impact on his brother Tom's life? Because of course there was quite an impact there as well, wasn't there?
Well, this is quite an extraordinary story, because you first of all got the theme of service, the sense of duty that defined Clem Attlee. And he saw that as his duty in World War One. And remember, he wasn't someone who was conscripted into the armed forces in World War One. This is somebody who joined up, who wanted to serve king and country. And indeed, if you look at his career from being one of the last on the beaches at Gallipoli, of course, which proved to be, in the end, a military catastrophe, frankly, for the British. If you look, too, at his service in what was then called Mesopotamia, if you look at his service in France as well, he was injured on two occasions and ends up in hospital, of course, in London. And nearby in the prison was his brother Tom. And his brother Tom was there because his brother Tom was a conscientious objector. And I think this is fascinating, because there is a lifelong correspondence between Clem Attlee and his brother Tom, which is a treasure trove for historians. But the fact Clem continued to write it shows to me that he had this quality necessary for all effective prime ministers. He could compartmentalize. He could put one part of his life in one place and move on and do something else with another part. Because if you put those two things together, Clem Attlee, injured in war, had put his life at risk time and time again. In contrast, obviously, to Tom, who was a conscientious objector, you could see a scenario where Clem became very resentful of his brother in the comparative safety of Britain when he was out risking his life. But actually, it showed Clem Attlee could compartmentalize and also showed, really, you know, his love of family, which I think is another defining feature throughout Attlee's career.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, after service ended, he was elected mayor of Stepney. Now, what was the impact of his time as mayor of Stepney? It was obviously quite a brief time that he served, but he did have an impact on him, didn't it?
He did have an impact, and I think there's two things that happen here. I think, firstly, he essentially runs the campaign where Labour takes control of the local council. Clem himself wasn't a candidate, but he gets invited, as you say, to be the mayor. And what he did see, again, in that role was the inequality that existed across between the richer London boroughs and the poorer London boroughs, which again reinforced this idea that it has to be the policy of central government if you want to produce more equal outcomes in society. But the second thing it did, his campaigning work, his service as mayor, gave him that stepping stone to be the Labour parliamentary candidate in Limehouse. It's essentially how he got to be in Parliament and gave him that parliamentary seat that was to be his base for the decades afterwards. And I think for both those reasons, that period is actually very, very important in the course that his life subsequently takes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, that election at Limehouse in 1922 was at a time when the Labour Party was really entering its own and would soon form a minority administration. In terms of that election and when Attlee first entered Parliament, what do you think his feelings were when he first entered Parliament as an MP? Do you think that he was aware of the scale of the challenge that was going to face Labour as it was coming not just into becoming the official opposition, but then eventually the government?
I think he had a sense that the times were changing. And those three general elections, 1922, 23 and 24, I would argue that taken together, they produce what is essentially today's party system, which is the two main political parties, Labour and Conservative, one being the principal opposition of the other at different times. And it put the Liberals into this third party position that they've never really recovered from properly in the time since. Now, Attlee, of course, comes in to Parliament in 1922. And this is the election where Labour has had one leader in the election, J.R. Clines, but the returning Ramsay MacDonald then becomes the leader after the election. And of course, I'm sure it'll come on in a moment, he had a quite complicated relationship with Ramsay MacDonald, because he starts off as his parliamentary PPS, his bag carrier, his eyes and ears in the parliamentary Labour Party, and saw at close quarters what pressures of the Labour leadership were like. But then, of course, because Labour ends up as a minority government in January 1924, then gets a taste of ministerial office where he becomes appropriately under-secretary at the War Office. Now, that would be a natural extension for Attlee. He'd served in World War I and he was also Major Attlee. And remember, they used to use their titles in the 1920s. So if you'd gone to Limehouse in this period, that their MP was Major Attlee. And so he ends up getting to a position in 1924 where he's already had a taste of ministerial office and seen the Labour leadership at close quarters. Both things would prove very useful.
Absolutely. And you touch upon that relationship with McDonald. How would you describe it? I mean, it wasn't necessarily throughout the course of their time together in Parliament the best relationship, was it?
No, and it began fairly well when he was McDonald's PBS. McDonald had appointed him then, as I say, to the War Office. But the relationship starts to go wrong in the later part of the 1920s. So in opposition, Clem Attlee was appointed to what became known as the Simon Commission after Chair Sir John Simon. And it was to look at the governance of India, which of course at that time was still under British rule. And there had been a Government of India Act in 1919 that had this periodic review every 10 years of governance arrangements. Now, Attlee very loyally serves on the commission. He goes out to India. He contributes very well to it. But had been told by McDonald that if Labour came back into power, he'd be appointed a minister and he shouldn't worry about serving on the Simon Commission being a disadvantage. Now, Labour comes back to power in May 1929, and Attlee comments, and he's very rarely negative about people in his autobiography, Attlee, but says that not only was he not appointed to the government, first of all, but McDonald didn't even have the courtesy to speak to him and tell him. You can see the relationship starting to go wrong because he thinks McDonald's broken a promise to him. Now, of course, what then happens is when Oswald Mosley resigns from that government, Attlee replaced him as Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. It's not too dissimilar to the kind of cabinet office role of the modern day, where he was at the centre of things, helping McDonald, whether it was with international conferences or particular areas. Like, for example, in agriculture, he often spoke about his worry about private profits being the motive above all else in certain farming communities. But he then briefly, towards the end of the government, becomes the Postmaster General for a few months as well. And this was the if you like, the avant-garde technology of the age. You know, how do you take apart and clean your telephone was one of the things that he had to deal with. But then comes the breach in his relationship with Ramsay MacDonald, because of course in the crisis of 1931, MacDonald leaves the Labour Party and becomes Prime Minister of the National Government, and Attlee is scathing about his performance, MacDonald's performance in the election of 1931, where he used to wave around banknotes that Attlee criticised him for, essentially saying Labour's a threat to the economy, neglecting the fact he'd been the Labour Prime Minister for the previous 2 years. And secondly, I think Attlee's sense of loyalty, duty, service just gave him this such a negative view of MacDonald from then on, and it their relationship never occurred.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you touched upon the Simon Commission there, and obviously this in many ways foreshadowed the eventual Act of Independence in 1948. What do you think we can judge as to how Attlee was forming his views of empire and in particular Indian independence from the Simon Commission? Do you think we can draw any comparisons between what came after and what he did whilst on the committee?
Because of Clem Attlee's own personal journey, we can trace it to the Simon Commission. And remember, for Attlee, it goes back even further, because Haileybury was regarded as the school to which those who became civil servants in India actually went to. So he's got this very long-standing link. And Attlee himself was always a realist, a pragmatist on India. And if you look at the Simon Commission, and what comes out of the Simon Commission initially is the Government of India Act of 1935. And there were things in it like provincial assemblies, essentially the first step on the road to what India is later to become, you know, a huge democracy. Baby steps, of course. There was still huge power for the British, for the Viceroy, still huge power. But it was starting to change, and a lot of the right-wing conservatives objected to it. But that then comes into force. But of course, you then have this other episode of Attlee's career where he is briefly Dominion Secretary in World War II, and they had huge problems in terms of protection of India. And he was the one who, ironically, of course, ordered the arrest of Gandhi and Nehru in World War II for reasons as he saw it. I mean, it was undoubtedly suppression. It was undoubtedly not something Attlee would ever have done in peacetime, but Attlee felt this was the necessity of war. And then you get to a stage in 1945 and independence for India and how that pans out. Attlee's leadership style was about allowing a decision to be reached. He very rarely led from the front in terms of forcing his own opinions on colleagues. You know, he famously said that democracy was about government by discussion, but it only works if you can stop people talking. And of course, that's how he saw cabinet efficient, reaching conclusions. But there were a couple of areas. One, which is a slightly different issue, but illustrates the point around Britain's development of its own nuclear deterrent, which was done in secret from most members of the cabinet. But secondly, on India, where Attlee, in effect, was his own Secretary of State for India. And of course, he makes that change of viceroy, where he changes Wavell for Mountbatten for the last few months, sets a deadline, and then of course you get independence for India. So there's a real, you know, Attlee's journey with India, it's not linear because you have to take into account the suppression in World War II, but he always has this interest and passion about India, which you could go back as far as Haileybury with, frankly. But we have to see all that as part of the journey to where he gets to. And later, you know, Francis Williams, who interviewed him, I think it was in the very early 1960s, asked him what he thought his greatest achievement was. And he said, India, possibly.
Absolutely. And he certainly was a significant achievement. But to go back to the 1930s and the 1931 election in particular, Attlee isn't sure when that election calls, if he wakes up the next morning, if he'll be a member of parliament the next day because of the colossal losses that Labour suffered in that 1931 general election. What do you think, when he awoke, found himself still a member of parliament, were his first thoughts? Do you think that he realised that out of the remaining MPs that Labour had at that point, that he was going to take a much more significant role in the leadership the party than he had previously?
It was obvious that he had to do that. And the sense he felt post that election, remember, he survived, I think it was 551 votes. It was a very, very narrow escape. And Labour has 52 MPs. Remember, they'd won 288 in 1929. So this was a decimation on a scale that, you know, even if we think of 1983 and 2019, they don't compare to this. This was a catastrophe. Now, the problem was that if you look at where MPs had survived, they tended to have survived in what are still the strong Labour areas today, the mining areas of the country. But they were MPs who wanted to be backbenchers. They were not MPs who had come in at a point they wanted to climb the greasy polls. So it was, and Attlee felt this profound sense again of duty and responsibility, because three people end up sharing the job of leader in effect, and they are George Lansbury, Stafford Cripps, and Clem Attlee. And they literally had to work around the clock to ensure that somebody was at the dispatch box to be able to carry out the functions of opposition. And there is no doubt, really, that it propelled Attlee from someone who was a middle-ranking, competent minister in both of Macdonald's, as it turned out, governments, to somebody who had literally now been thrust forward into the leadership by virtue of the circumstances. But it is to Attlee's huge credit that, of course, when it came to the leadership election of 1935, he emerges from that as the leader.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And could you just explain how he managed to emerge as leader of 1935, because it's quite an interesting story, particularly in terms of his relationship with George Lansbury.
Yes, so the issue, the defining foreign policy issue of the 1930s is obviously the aggression of dictators, whether that's Hitler, Mussolini, for example, and how Britain responded to it. And the big change that happens in the Labour Party is to move from George Lansbury, who was a pacifist, to a position where in 1939, Clem Attlee could support the country in war and actually ends up, of course, joining the war cabinet, being deputy prime minister. Now, what happens here in 1935 is that Ernest Bevin at the party conference attacks George Lansbury and tells him that, look at what's happening around Europe. Your conscience should be a still, small voice, and essentially destroys Lansbury's leadership. Now, Attlee then becomes caretaker leader for the 1935 election. So in a sense, he's the sitting tenant. So when it comes to the post-election leadership, because Labour gets 154 seats, so they've gained 102 seats, but frankly, they're still nowhere near government. And there are three candidates for the leadership. There's Clem Attlee, Herbert Morrison, and there is then Arthur Greenwood. And what happens is, on the first round, Attlee comes top, Morrison second, Greenwood third, and then Attlee wins on the second ballot. But there's a number of factors around this. I think, firstly, people did see the person who was going to be the leader as quite temporary. But I think it says a great deal that, having lost that leadership election, Herbert Morrison decided to concentrate on his role as leader of the London County Council, because he thought, frankly, he was more powerful doing that than as a member of a parliamentary party of 154 people. But secondly, and this is to Attlee's credit, the MPs of that 1931-35 Parliament had genuinely liked working for Attlee, and there was a lot of loyalty to Attlee in that group. But I think that, combined with the fact that he was the sitting tenant, the acting leader, which showed that he could do the job, combined to make him the leader in 1935. But as I say, the qualifier is everybody thought it was a temporary job. Nobody thought that the person who was going to be that leader was going to be the prime minister.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And of course, before Attlee eventually becomes prime minister, he joins Churchill's war cabinet. Now, could you just explain the degree to which Churchill eventually becoming prime minister was down to Attlee? Because there is a perception, isn't there, quite an accurate one, that Attlee played a pivotal role in that decision.
Yeah, and so this is interesting, isn't it? Because the war obviously breaks out in September 1939 with the Nazi invasion of Poland. Now, this is the period of what's called the phony war, where war had been declared, but the Blitz hadn't begun. It was obviously not the start of the war in Western Europe as we understand it now, with later, of course, that comes with the Nazi invasion of the Low Countries and France in 1940. Now, there was no way that the Labour front bench would have served under Neville Chamberlain. Neville Chamberlain had pursued a policy of appeasement that had ultimately failed. And things reach a crisis point in May of 1940, where the Nazis have gone through the Low Countries. France is on the verge of falling. And you have what was known as the famous Norway debate, which was about the theatre of conflict in Norway. And although Chamberlain does win the debate, the Tory rebellion is so big, there's a massive fall in the government majority. And then it comes down to who would replace Neville Chamberlain. And it essentially came down to a choice between Halifax, Viscount Halifax, who was the Foreign Secretary, and indeed Winston Churchill, who had been a very controversial figure in Labour circles in earlier decades, but had called Hitler's aggression right in the 1930s. And this is where, you know, Labour will not serve under Chamberlain. Labour will serve under Churchill. And then you get this war cabinet, which is originally a war cabinet of five people, Greenwood and Attlee, Halifax, Chamberlain and Churchill. Of course, it changes and Neville Chamberlain dies and Halifax goes off to be ambassador to the US. But that, I think, shows Attlee's influence at that key moment in our history.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And do you think you could just explain the relationship between Attlee and Churchill? Because there's been a certain degree of, I think, misnomer about the degree of respect that they had for one another. There's the famous black cab remark that Churchill is said to have been given, but of course he didn't, and he rebuked someone who repeated it to him. Could you just explain what that relationship really was like?
Yeah, I mean, there was, and I think most definitely in the 1950s in particular, there was a strong mutual respect between them. And you can see Attlee lined up with the other pallbearers at Churchill's funeral. But obviously they had their ups and downs in too. Attlee, as he was to be as prime minister, believed in efficient dispatch of government business. Used to get extremely frustrated that Churchill would sometimes turn up, A, had not read the briefing notes, and secondly, as Attlee saw it, often would start just going off in different directions on particular attitudes that he had. And Churchill, in the end, sent him a quite strong note rebuking him, saying he was making it really difficult to run the government. I sent Churchill into a sort of huge rage, and was going to send this really awful missive back to Attlee about what he really thought of him and all this kind of thing. So there were certainly ups and downs in the Second World because they were so different. That, you know, you had Churchill, of course, with, you know, the hugely persuasive oratory towards the end of the war, going to those great conferences at Tehran and at Yalta, and later, of course, at Potsdam, where Attlee takes over. Whereas Attlee is far, you know, quieter, not really very well known by the public, but very effective at getting government to work. But what happens over time, particularly in the 1950s when they've both been prime minister for significant periods, you do get this strong mutual respect. And there were courtesies between them, courtesies between their wives, courtesy even when Attlee took over in 1945, when Churchill came back in 51, allowing each other to stay on at Chequers if they wanted, and, you know, great personal courtesy between them.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And when Attlee becomes prime minister in 1945, there certainly is a sense, at least from some commentators, that it's a bit unexpected as to Labour winning that election, despite opinion polling prior indicating that Labour was going to win. How prepared do you think Attlee was for taking office in 1945?
Well, it's fascinating, this, because the distrust of opinion polling is what's significant here. So if you look at mass observation, the very early form of opinion polling, from 1943 onwards, it's clearly predicting Labour will win. But in a sense, people were still in the last war. They thought, just as Lloyd George had triumphed in that Coupon election of 1918 as the man who'd won the war, you know, I had another man who'd won the war, Winston Churchill, who would just ride to victory. And indeed, Churchill himself was personally pretty popular, but the conservative brand was not. And what happens in 1945 is that, you know, Morrison expected a strong Labour performance around London, but few expected it. And then you get this landslide victory. And remember that it took 3 weeks to count the votes because the service people were all around the world. So it took these 3 weeks to get all the votes in. Labour did very well amongst the forces vote, and people at the count saw them being brought in and could see Labour had done very, very well in that sense. But what then happens is, although at one level they weren't prepared for government in the sense that they hadn't quite expected this and certainly hadn't expected the scale of the win, nonetheless, the kind of things they'd been arguing for for the best, you know, over 10 years, some would argue 14 years. You could even argue with Attlee, if you look at Attlee in the 1920s in opposition, arguing for things like public ownership of energy, like electricity, in a sense, they had a body of policy work going back decades in terms of the welfare state, the nationalizations, that they did have that preparatory work that they were then able to actually put into effect.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And of course, as you mentioned there, nationalization was a major part of that. The Beveridge Report obviously was something that had a great influence on Labour's 1945 election campaign. But the task that the Labour government at the time faced was massive, wasn't it? Just simply, for example, in terms of housing, because of how many houses had been destroyed as a result of the Blitz. Looking at those first years before the winter of 47, 48, what do you think the kind of priorities were in terms of Attlee's mind in what he wanted his ministers to do?
Well, Attlee had huge ambition around the welfare state, the NHS, housing, literally wanted to transform the lot of working people. Now, the problem was initially the financial position. I mean, John Maynard Keynes, who looked at Britain's military Dunkirk in 1940 and said this was the financial Dunkirk. And they managed to plug the gap with a loan from the United States, which wasn't finally paid off until under the premiership of Tony Blair, by the way. So it took many decades. Once they'd secured that American loan, they then went about, you know, the welfare state. That, of course, the idea of old age pensions, the you know, concept of national insurance goes back to the new liberal government of Asquith, Campbell Bannerman, and then Asquith. But this was the first at scale reform that made such a big difference. They then, obviously, the National Health Services Act was on the statute book in 1946. And then, of course, Aniram Bevan, as Minister of Health and Housing, was starting to build houses as well. Of course, they then continued to pace with the nationalisation. So it was a huge amount of reform.
And it was reform as well that, in terms of the way that it was translated to the public, it was very important the degree to which people were able to understand it, particularly in terms of the NHS, wasn't it? Because this was quite a significant step for medical practitioners. There were quite a number of doctors who were at the time opposed to the creation of the NHS, weren't there?
There were, and there were, and Aniram Bevan essentially had to fight two battles here. The first battle, where he had Attlee's support, was in cabinet, and it was in the later part of 1945, and it was who ran the hospitals. Now, Herbert Morrison wanted local authorities to run the hospitals, thought that his London County Council medical service of the 30s had treated around about 90,000 patients a year and wanted to give local government that status. And Aniram Bevan, who'd served both on the Tredegar Urban District Council and Monmouthshire County Council, felt local authorities were vulnerable to central government funding cuts. And Attlee leaned in very heavily so that Bevan won that first battle. The problem then becomes, though, who works in your NHS? Now, Aniram Bevan, very quickly, in terms of the amount that nurses were paid, the way that he treated nurses with a great deal of respect, with the nurses were on board. The doctors, however, were very much not. And Bevan had to here deal with some very deep dilemmas, because doctors saw themselves as independent professionals. They did not want to be ordered by the government to go to particular parts of the country. They said they were not full-time salaried civil servants. Now, there's a fundamental problem with this, though, isn't there? Because if you want a universal healthcare system, you have to have power to direct them, because of some areas are more doctors than others. So Nye Bevan, a combination of carrot and stick. The stick was, if the NHS doesn't come into being, it's your fault and I'm going to blame you for it. But the carrot was, of course, a combination of ensuring they were properly remunerated for their old practices, and allowing private work to continue. And of course, he later said famously, "I stuffed their mouths with gold."
And it was certainly, obviously, in the long term, a highly effective plan. I'd like to turn now to the winter of 1947. This obviously had a major impact on the ability of the Attlee government to function and the entire country to function as well. Could you just explain what exactly happened in that winter and why it was so significant for the government and for the people of Britain?
So what happens here is that the winter of 47-48 was a particularly dreadful winter. But the criticism of the government was that they hadn't heeded the warnings. They hadn't properly stopped coal, which of course was the principal fuel. And as a consequence, you had people literally freezing in their homes. The Minister of Fuel and Power, Emmanuel Shinwell, became something of a poster boy for the Conservatives. They shiver with Shinwell was the great line that they used on him. And blame started to be pointed in Attlee's direction as to how the government could have misjudged this so badly. And it isn't just to say that this was a particularly deep winter. There were a few incidents where Attlee's hands-off leadership approach had meant that things had just continued as normal. And of course, continuing as normal was not adequate for that particular winter. And it was the first time really that the government started to be really shook badly by people, the very people they were meant to represent, being badly affected by what was perceived as their incompetence at the top level. And it was a pointer towards how the government was to start to find itself in more difficulties as the years went on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, 48, as we already touched upon, was also the year of the partition of India. In terms of not just that, but other foreign affair relations that Attlee had, his relationship with Truman, the Korean War, how do you think he engaged with foreign affairs? Do you think he was able to, despite obviously not having necessarily the most hands-on approach in some instances, do you think he was able to engage with foreign affairs in a particularly constructive way?
He did. He did in 1950 with Truman, but he took the hands-off approach and allowed Ernest Bevin to run foreign affairs. I mean, he famously said, "If you've got a good dog, why bother to bark yourself?" with regard to Ernest Bevin. But of course, Ernest Bevin was ill in 1950. So he had to, after the Korean War had broken out, went to see Truman. And what Attlee wanted to do, essentially, was to stop Truman using nuclear weapons again, at least get some sort of position where Truman would have to consult the UK before doing something on that scale. And in that, he was quite successful. Where he was less successful was in accepting this enormous defence programme of £4,000 million that is essentially what leads to the resignations of John Freeman and Iron Bevan and Harold Wilson in 1951 in the government's dying days.
And of course, as we come up to 1951, this is of course an unfortunate time for the government to have an election, particularly given the previous year's general election in 1950, and Attlee leaves office then. How do you think that he felt in 1951 on leaving office? Do you think he was convinced that he would only shortly be out of office and would return soon, or?
No, I think it's quite a sad story of misjudgments 1950-51, because the first general election of February 1950, for a start, that's a bad month to have an election in the depths of winter. But also because Stafford Cripps, the Chancellor, was such a sense of high-minded morals, he wouldn't do a pre-election budget. When you think of the later chancellors who very happily did pre-election budgets, but Cripps wouldn't. And that knocks the majority down to 5. But remember, you've by then got quite a group of people who've been in office since 1940. Some have been in office, like Attlee himself, for over 10 years. You've also got a parliamentary party that they're not all young. A lot of them are quite older, elderly, find it very difficult to keep coming to Parliament. So trying to sustain a majority of five was always going to be difficult. The problem, though, again, was that they end up having a second election where they lose power in October 1951. You could argue they were unlucky. They had more votes in that election than before or since. And also, they had more votes than the Conservatives, but the Conservatives won more seats. However, had the government waited until the spring of 1952, 5-6 months down the line, they could have benefited from the economic upswing. So I think on both cases, they got the timing of the elections wrong. But there is a deeper point here as well. There was a symposium at Dorking in June of 1950 that's very instructive to read. And in a sense, the Attlee government was a victim of its own success. They'd achieved so much. They'd achieved almost all the things in their manifesto. But the question then became, what happens now? Do you deepen the nationalisation programme? And speaking, you know, pragmatically, the problem is there wasn't much left to nationalise. I think they came up with a sugar beet industry in the end. Or did you do as Herbert Morrison argued, accept that you had embedded these great reforms? What you now needed to do was to reduce what was left of rationing, reduce what was left of the wartime controls, and start to focus on how you produce the conditions for private consumer affluence in the 1950s. I mean, and Morrison was prescient, actually, as to how the 1950s was to pan out. And they never really resolved that tension for the 1951 election. And of course, then end up in opposition for 13 years afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in that period from 1951 to 1955, when Attlee eventually steps down, what do you think he was thinking of in terms of his future? Obviously, the 1955 election sees the Conservatives continue in office. They win that election and Attlee steps down afterwards. But do you think in that four-year period, he thought of life after frontline politics, or do you think you had thought of that?
This is, again, Attlee's sense of purpose and duty, because he saw his role as trying to keep the party together. He obviously had the Bevanite group in the early 50s who were going around the constituencies with their brains trusts. You had on the right of the party, you had Hugh Gaitskill, who thought that Clem Attlee essentially should strongly discipline these people for not sticking to the party lines. You had this real dispute within the party where Attlee saw his role as trying to hold the party together to fight another day. What's also interesting, though, is, of course, his another complex relationship of his with Herbert Morrison. I mean, he'd not forgotten Herbert Morrison's attempt to take the leadership from him in the hours after the 1945 landslide. And one of the effects of Attlee staying in post until 1955 was to pass the leadership on a generation. And when you come to the 1955 election for Labour leader, again amongst the MPs, like 1935, it's amazing, isn't it? 20-year period as Labour leader. What happens is that Herbert Morrison ends up a poor third. And Nyren Bevan comes second because Bevan and Gaitskill are the representatives of the next generation. And it's Hugh Gaitskill who then decisively wins the leadership in 1955. Though I can't help observing either, if you look at the latest episode of Labour's factional infighting of the 1950s, the next Labour Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, proves to be somebody who was a Bevanite who came to an accommodation with the Gaitskillites. Which may be one of the reasons why he was as skillful a party manager he was later to be.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, Nick. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak to me. But I do have one final question. Obviously, we've discussed Attlee's career throughout this podcast. If you were to meet Clement Attlee somehow through some magical window into another time, what do you think you'd like to say to it?
I would just like to have the pleasure of explaining. You know, Clem Attlee has that interview in 1961 where he talks about India as his great achievement. And of course, that's a monumental thing to have done, no doubt about that. But what I would just love to show to Clem Attlee is how, his reforms from NATO to the NHS to the welfare state have endured for all these decades afterwards. And of course, it's the one thing that our former prime ministers can never see, what really happens to their reforms decades and decades later. And I just like to show him how everything that he did continued to shape the politics of our country for so many decades afterwards, and to just ask him, did he ever think that might be the case?
I think that's a wonderful thing, and something that if you do ever get the opportunity somehow, I'm sure that you very much appreciate. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Nick. If people want to find out more about you or want to buy a copy of the book, where should they go to do those things?
So all good bookshops, as they say, Will, but it's available online. It's available from all the leading bookstores. So just type in Attlee, A Life in Politics. And I hope that people do enjoy the book and get to know a bit more about Clem Attlee.
I'm sure they will. It's a wonderful book. Thank you once again for coming on, Nick.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.